Previously on Red Pilled America.
Well, can you tell us what Twitter is?
It's basically mini blogging.
And at the end of that 2 weeks, I wrote the first tweet, which was inviting coworkers.
Jack Dorsey had a very laissez-faire approach to moderation.
Twitter was being used to give firsthand eyewitness accounts of what was happening on the ground.
Journalists loved the tool.
Tonight, the questions Democratic Congressman Anthony Weiner is refusing to answer.
I've seen a lot of this congressman's body.
So today I'm announcing my resignation from Congress.
Conservatives were quietly becoming experts at using this new social media tool.
We're the free speech wing of the Free Speech Party.
It became apparent that the media was losing its grip on the narrative, and they'd have to do something about it. I'm Patrick Carelci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show.
This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks. Stories about everyday Americans that the globalists ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing. The truth.
Welcome to Red Pilled America.
We're at the second part of our series of episodes entitled Unfiltered. You've probably heard part one, but if you haven't, stop and go back and listen from the beginning. We're looking for the answer to the question, why is the media afraid of free speech? By telling the story of Twitter and how it drifted away from being the free speech platform.
So in part one, we followed the early career of Jack Dorsey and how he became a programmer for a new podcasting company called Odeo. That task was short-lived because soon after Jack joined the team, Apple got into the podcasting business. It destroyed Odeo's business model. The company had to make a quick pivot, and they turned to Jack Dorsey for ideas. He came up with what eventually would become Twitter, a microblogging site that turned out to be so much more. Twitter was instantly popular with journalists because it could give fast, on-the-ground reporting in short, concise messages, or tweets. We then explored perhaps the first indication that Twitter would become a powerful communication tool by telling the story of a 2011 scandal known as Wienergate, when Andrew Breitbart and his band of rebel journalists used Twitter to expose the lies of a sitting Democrat congressman, Anthony Weiner. The team eventually forced Weiner to resign. The whole affair would have massive political implications, but we'll get to that later. By the end of Wienergate, Twitter management had already gone through major turmoil. Jack Dorsey had been forced out as CEO and was placed in the largely figurehead position of chairman. The new CEO claimed that Twitter was the free speech wing of the Free Speech Party. But in the years that followed, that claim would be put to the test by a band of outcasts, a community you'd never think could impact our free speech rights.
Gamers. It's hard to find a more maligned group. Branded as fat, nerdy, pimple-popping, virgin white males living in their parents' basement, gamers are perhaps the most unlikely hero in the modern culture war. But these societal misfits became just that, and their weapon was Twitter. In 2014, building on the hashtag Wienergate strategy, gamers went toe-to-toe with a woke battalion that had infiltrated their community. The battle became known as hashtag Gamergate, and it would oddly become one of the most consequential moments in the life of Jack Dorsey's creation. Like many epic wars throughout history, it all started with a spurned lover. It was mid-August 2014, and a young man named Aaron published a tell-all story about the breakup with his ex-girlfriend, a woman that went by the moniker Zoe Quinn. Zoe was a young tattooed video game developer whose hair alternated between pink, blue, purple, and bleach blonde. Aaron accused her of being a two-timing liar who'd been canoodling with multiple men behind his back. To the uninitiated, the blog post seemed a bit vengeful, maybe even petty. It appeared to be just another heartbroken personal account of a short-lived love affair. According to Aaron, he and Zoe met on the dating app OkCupid. They connected over a shared interest in gaming. He helped her develop a video game. The relationship went through twists and turns, then ended after her alleged infidelity with at least 5 different men, and he claimed to have the receipts. Aaron posted many of their online exchanges. In one of them, it appeared Zoe not only admitted to cheating on him with her married boss, but also to raping Aaron, or at least by her definition of rape. In one screenshot Aaron shared, Zoe allegedly exclaimed that if Aaron exposed the adulterous affair to her boss's wife, it would not only ruin the video game she was developing, it would likely hurt all female game developers in the male-dominated industry. Her argument didn't fly. Aaron posted all the dirt anyway. By his account, he wanted to expose her betrayal to save others from falling into her spell. Zoe would later reportedly claim his accusations weren't true. Most of us have seen this kind of dirty laundry aired on social media. It wasn't unprecedented, but to hardcore gamers, this simple blog post was a gift of epic proportions. You see, at the time in 2014, gamers were under siege.
Two years earlier, a radical feminist launched a campaign.
Have you ever noticed that, with a few notable exceptions, basically all female characters in video games fall into a small handful of cliches and stereotypes? I'm Anita Sarkeesian, and I run the video web series Feminist Frequency. As a pop culture critic, I look at movies, TV shows, comic books, and, of course, video games.
In 2012, Anita Sarkeesian introduced a crowdfunding campaign asking for donations to produce a series of videos analyzing the alleged misogynistic storylines in video games.
Many games tend to reinforce and amplify sexist and downright misogynist ideas about women. In this particular project, which I'm calling Tropes vs. Women in Video Games, I'm going to create a series of 5 videos that look at and deconstruct the most common and the most stereotypical representations of women in games. Video games are an integral and growing part of our popular culture today, and as with all pop culture media, the gaming industry is playing a role in helping to shape our society, either by challenging or more often reinforcing existing values, beliefs, and behaviors.
The woke feminist didn't like the way women were portrayed in some video games, and she was on a mission to reform the industry's sexist ways.
This new video series will primarily focus on tracking 5 stereotypical representations of women throughout the history of video games. I'm going to look at the damsel in distress, the fighting toy, the sexy sidekick, the sexy villainess, and the most common trope in video games, women as background decoration.
Her campaign appeared intentionally provocative, and it drew annoyed criticism from gamers. But Anita was smart. She channeled their response into her own victim narrative and claimed she was being harassed by the sexist boys' club of gaming. Anita was now the damsel in distress, and she needed feminists everywhere to come to her rescue by donating to her campaign. Well, it worked. Over the span of a month, Anita snagged almost $160,000, at the time, a hefty amount for a crowdfunding project. 9 months later, she slowly began publishing her critique videos, each making the argument that the gaming industry was plagued with misogyny.
Welcome to our multi-part video series. Welcome to the second episode. Welcome to the third episode in our multi-part series exploring the roles and representations of women in video games. Let's jump right into The Damsel in Distress.
Mario!
As a trope, the damsel in distress is a plot device in which a female character is placed in a perilous situation from which she cannot escape on her own and then must be rescued by a male character, usually providing an incentive or motivation for the protagonist's quest. The damsel trope typically makes men the subject of narratives while relegating women to the role of object. This is a form of objectification because as objects, damseled women are being acted upon. Most often becoming or reduced to a prize to be won, a treasure to be found, or a goal to be achieved.
She tracked this sexism back to the 1980s arcade favorite, Donkey Kong, where a King Kong-like gorilla captures Princess Peach, and the hero, Mario, is tasked with saving her.
I've heard it said that in the game of patriarchy, women are not the opposing team, they are the ball. So, for example, we can think of the Super Mario franchise as a grand game being played between Mario and Bowser, and Princess Peach's role is essentially that of the ball. The two men are tossing her back and forth over the course of the main series, each trying to keep and take possession of the damsel ball.
Anita used a critique plucked from a university gender studies class and applied it to the world of gaming.
The damsel in distress is not just a synonym for weak. Instead, it works by ripping away the power from female characters, even helpful or seemingly capable ones. No matter what we're told about their magical abilities, skills, or strengths, they're still ultimately captured or otherwise incapacitated and then must wait for rescue. The reality is, this trope is being used in a real-world context where backward sexist attitudes are already rampant. It's a sad fact that a large percentage of the world's population still clings to the deeply sexist belief that women as a group need to be sheltered, protected, and taken care of by men. The belief that women are somehow a naturally weaker gender is a deeply ingrained, socially constructed myth, which of course is completely false. But the notion is reinforced and perpetuated when women are continuously portrayed as frail, fragile, and vulnerable creatures.
She closed out each episode with a call to action within the gaming community to change its sexist ways.
Women shouldn't be mere disposable objects or symbolic pawns in stories about men and their own struggles with patriarchal expectations and inadequacies. It's long past time to disrupt the established pattern, break the cycle, and create new gender paradigm.
Anita Sarkeesian's videos were a smash hit among the woke feminist crowd. They racked up millions of views, and her attacks began to apply a new kind of pressure within the gaming community. The industry was no stranger to being attacked. Since the 90s, conservatives and the religious right had accused the gaming industry of inspiring violence in the real world. But Anita's attack was something new. Her criticism appeared to be coming from within the industry, because Anita claimed to be a gamer.
I've been playing video games since I was about 5 years old.
This is a photo of me at age 10 playing Super Mario World on the Super Nintendo. So I've been playing games for quite a while.
I think games are really where we're going.
So again, I've been playing games for a while.
Video games are so interesting and engaging and interactive. I'm a gamer and I enjoy games. I love games. I'm a fan of games.
The far-left mainstream media heaped praise on the videos. The New York Times, the Boston Globe, Newsweek, and others encouraged readers to support Anita's reform effort. Gaming websites like Kotaku and Polygon, all populated by far-left journalists, loved Anita's radical feminist message, and they positioned her as the gamer that was starting a much-needed dialogue within the world of gaming. Well, like every other branch of entertainment, the gaming industry fell in line with the media. At its 2014 Game Developers Choice Awards, it bestowed her with an honor.
The Ambassador Award honors an individual who has helped the game industry advance to a better place. Anita Sarkeesian's work has done just that. Anita saw an opportunity to create, in her words, a space where feminism was easy to engage with in an accessible way. She loves video games. She's so passionate about them that she feels they're worth fighting for. It is my honor to present the Game Developers Ambassador Award to Anita Sarkeesian.
Wow, thank you. I'm incredibly surprised to be receiving this award and super honored. This is the first time the GDC Ambassador Award has been given to a woman. I know that many of you are ready and willing to take that challenge and make gaming a more inclusive space for people of all genders. I'm honored to be a small part of that change, and I'm excited to see where we go from here.
Gamers were being branded as sexist from one of their own. As the summer of 2014 arrived, they'd had just about enough. The joystick soldiers wanted to mount a counterattack, but they needed something to rally behind. And that would come with Aaron Salacious' post about his girlfriend's infidelity.
Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So by the summer of 2014, gamers had had enough of Anita Sarkeesian's feminist attack on their beloved hobby. They wanted to mount a counterattack. A few began posting videos analyzing the flaws in her analysis.
If you go to places where you can discuss her videos, which is basically anywhere where she can't delete your comments, you'll find example after example of how she's just cherry-picked and completely misrepresented games. Two very clear examples is where she used the game Watch Dogs on the very mission where you have to try and shut down a sex trafficking ring. Well, how can you possibly portray that as objectifying women? Well, she found a way.
And almost never get to be anything other than set dressing or props in someone else's narrative. This is the essence of what sexual objectification means.
She takes a mission where you're trying to shut down a sex trafficking ring and portrays that as sexist.
These responses began racking up tens of thousands of views, but it wasn't until Aaron aired his dirty laundry with his ex-girlfriend Zoe Quinn that a movement began to take shape. You see, Zoe Quinn was part of this feminist infiltration of the gaming community. She'd developed a strange pseudo-game called Depression Quest. The user simulated being depressed by reading a passage, then clicking on various links that took them down a fictional story of depression. It had multiple endings depending on what you clicked, but it was more like an interactive story than an actual game. Many gamers didn't consider it a game at all, and they were creeped out that Zoe chose to launch it on the day that Robin Williams committed suicide. Adding to their surprise was that the gaming media oddly heaped praise on Depression Quest. Gamers began to suspect that it was simply because she was a feminist, kind of like an affirmative action for female game developers. But Aaron's post about Zoe's alleged infidelities offered a new hypothesis. If his accusations were true, it suggested that Zoe Quinn was shacking up with key people within the gaming world to get ahead. To many gamers, Aaron's post was a godsend. The entire industry was being branded by feminists as sexist, and yet here was a prominent gaming feminist allegedly sleeping around with the people that could benefit her career. It not only showed hypocrisy, but it showed potential corruption within gaming journalism, and that was no small deal. At the time, global gaming revenue was estimated to be over $80 billion. Corruption in the gaming media had massive implications. Aside from shifting gamers' attention to certain titles, the industry media affected gaming developers' pocketbooks in other ways. Many of them received bonuses on how the media covered their work. So if a feminist gamer was reaping financial benefits by sleeping around, what other corruption was lurking behind the curtain? Aaron's salacious blog post was a gift the gamers couldn't pass up on. They now had the artillery needed to face their adversary, and it was not going to be a fair fight, because the radical feminists picked the one group that was committed to winning at all costs. It's what they did 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. So, they began sleuthing Aaron's post, looking for the men Zoe Quinn allegedly shagged during the critical time she released Depression Quest. One was a writer from a gaming site that promoted Zoe's game. Gamers began combing through Zoe's public donors and found that many journalists from their industry had given her donations, an obvious conflict of interest. They also found nude modeling pictures of Zoe, claiming the pictures underscored the possibility she'd use her body for financial gain. Gamers began pressing the media to cover this potential corruption within their industry. They were ignored. Gamers turned to the online forums on gaming news sites to discuss the growing controversy, but the moderators of the forums either mocked them or outright deleted their comments. Gamers turned to Zoe's Wikipedia page and attempted to add information highlighting the growing controversy. An editing war ensued, and the moderators of the site locked the page and purged it of the gamers' criticisms. The gamers turned to chatting forums like Reddit to discuss their frustrations with the media and their refusal to address the corruptions in their ranks. And even there, the moderators of the sites deleted thousands of posts on the topic. Gamer groups from opposing online chat communities, typically arch rivals, began to come together to voice their outrage on places like Twitter and YouTube.
Now, this entire thing started off with a sex scandal. That's what began this all. You know, Zoe Quinn and the Five Guys. Zoe Quinn has alleged relationships with different people in the industry, and these people may or may not have helped her career out. In fact, it's created a bizarre, strange sort of alliance between websites which hate each other, whose user bases mock and deride each other on a daily basis, which have never agreed on anything except this one thing. When you see websites like Tumblr and Reddit, 4chan and GameFAQs, and even FunnyJunk all saying with one voice, "We're not going to fuck off, we're not going to be mocked and told to go away, we are going to talk about this, there is something going on," despite their differences, despite the hatred those user bases have for one another, then that should tell you something about how bad game journalism and game development in the indie scene is.
The gamers were pissed and were running out of options. Their media wouldn't cover their own corruption. They wouldn't allow them to discuss it in their comments section. Even third-party chat rooms were prohibiting discussions on this media corruption. It was almost as if these sites were all colluding. So the gamers returned to Twitter, the one online free speech forum that wasn't censoring their discussions on the topic. And that's when they finally started to get a response.
For the past few days, we've seen multitudes of examples of suppression and trying to prohibit people from talking about this. We've seen biased narratives put forward on websites with headlines such as "The Anti-Feminist Internet Targets Depression Quest Game Creator, Zoe Quinn," or "The Sexist Crusade to Destroy Game Developer, Zoe Quinn." We've seen websites which are wholly dedicated to discussing gaming, to discussing the industry and all the events and information that surrounds it, having threads where private correspondences are mocked by the administrator, where dissenters are banned, and where conversation is closed after the groupthink is allowed. On Reddit, one of the larger subreddits which exist, rgaming, had a thread with over 25,000 comments in it, thousands upon thousands of which were deleted outright by a moderator who had claimed to the user base that Zoe Quinn wasn't relevant, that the information wasn't important, that there's no conspiracy going on, that they just want to maintain order and decorum. And yet, that very same person is seen on Twitter having conversations with Zoe Quinn while deletions are happening. It's now been 7 days since the Zoe Post blog first went up online. In the time since then, numerous new allegations along with pieces of evidence have come forward showing different kinds of relationships that have existed between the gaming press and different developers. These relationships have run the gamut from close friendships to sexual and or romantic relationships to even financial support. There have been allegations that have been mounting that there's favoritism shown and that there's bias in the coverage. And yet, throughout it all, the gaming press refuses to address any of it, instead insisting to call the people that are interested in finding out the truth misogynistic or sexist or nutcases and idiots. And with every single blog post that you write saying you won't negotiate with terrorists as if in labeling us like that is somehow going to make us go away, you just prove that you don't know what you're up against.
These guys were gamers. Their hobby was about winning. It was part of the community's DNA. They continued to press the conversation on Twitter, and chatter got so loud that a few of the gaming news websites implicated in the alleged corruption addressed the issue. Polygon issued a statement stating that, effective immediately, they were going to require staff to disclose donations they've made to gaming developers. On the same day, another gaming news outlet, Kotaku, issued a statement as well, promising transparency when a video game reviewer has a personal relationship with the developer of the game they're reviewing. They also adopted a policy prohibiting their writers from donating to game developers, like some had done with Zoe Quinn.
That's when the whole affair got a hashtag. A Twitter user dubbed the controversy #Gamergate, and a movement was born. It became the top trend on Twitter, and by this time, Twitter was the default dashboard of journalists. The media now had no choice but to address the issue, and they responded with a carpet bomb of stories defending Zoe Quinn and Anita Sarkeesian. Astonishingly, gamer media sites began writing obituaries to the term gamer. Kotaku ran with the headline, "We might be witnessing the death of an identity." GameDeveloper.com was more direct. It went with the headline, "Gamers don't have to be your audience. Gamers are over." Unbelievably, gamer journalists were turning on their own audience. But it didn't stop the gamers. They continued their counterattack on Zoe Quinn and Anita Sarkeesian. They wanted the feminists to get the f*** out of gaming. These woke infiltrators were putting pressure on the storytellers of the video game industry, the game developers, putting pressure on them to change their stories to make them more inclusive, to make them more woke. And all the gamers cared about was playing good games.
It has now been 2 weeks since the Zoe Post blog first went up online, and in the span of 14 days, a lot of things have happened. One of the most striking of which would be the pushback on the part of gamers. It is a pushback against a corrupt gaming press, and believe me, when I say they are corrupt, that is exactly what they are. When this first started coming to light, they originally tried silence. They simply sought to ignore it and hope that it went away, but it didn't. When that failed, they moved on to censorship, and yet that did not work. When censorship failed, they moved on to what they're doing now, which is mockery and attacking. And it will fail just like the past two attempts did. What they are not taking into account is people have had enough. And a prime example of that is the fact that we're even still talking about this.
They cited Twitter's influence in their movement.
We are on day 14 with a f***ing hashtag Gamergate. that we were on day 14 with people in the movie industry, the television industry, the fucking music industry commenting on this. We are on day 14 where websites have some of the largest threads in their fucking history dedicated to this very thing. It is not going away, it is not diminishing, and it is not dying. And that speaks volumes to what is happening, because the internet is a place where things happen in quick succession. You are lucky if you can keep the internet's attention for a day, let alone 2 entire weeks. And yet, still, the gaming media, the gaming press, these supposed so-called journalists are trying to act as if there's nothing here, that there's no corruption, that nothing needs to be addressed, or that anything that has been addressed as a result of the sustained pressure is not a big deal. That it's really not as big as you think. There's no conspiracy, there's no collusion. You're all just deluding yourselves and thinking that things are taking place and they're not really happening. But we, the game journalists, we have your best interest in mind, so just shut the f*** up and we'll tell you what to think. Zoe Quinn and Aaron had a relationship. Zoe Quinn, like Max Temkin, is a game developer. Max Temkin was accused of rape and denied the allegations. Both Rock Paper Shotgun and Kotaku decided to run articles about Max Temkin, but you both have remained silent about Zoe Quinn. I find that interesting because in the records that are provided by the ex-boyfriend, Zoe Quinn admits to raping him. This is a screenshot from the blog post, The Zoe Post. Look at article number 4. I'm going to read this to you. Views on the ethics of infidelity, which she maintained is inherently wrong even if the person who was cheated on never finds out. Because aside from willfully endangering their partner by the way of increased STD risk, if the unfaithful party then has sex with their partner, they are doing so under false pretenses, and therefore without their partner's consent. That is, sex with a partner who doesn't know you've cheated on them is sex without consent.
The Gamergate movement was pissed. A month earlier, gaming news site Kotaku ran a story about an alleged rape accusation against a male game developer. To the Gamergate crowd, this reeked of hypocrisy because the same site refused to address the issue of a feminist game developer involved in a potentially similar scandal.
When they are presented with evidence that Zoe Quinn willfully admits that she had sex without consent, that she raped someone, they don't think that's worth talking about. They don't think it's an ethical double standard. You don't think there's a journalistic question of f***ing integrity? This goes to prove that there is an agenda-driven purpose behind editorial pieces that are put up on these websites. They have no problem doing this to a man, but they will not do it to a woman. A man is accused of rape and the man denies the allegation, they run the story. A woman admits to rape and they refuse to run the story. And you're telling me there aren't ethical questions involved? The scandal, and that is what it is. We're talking about a scandal related to relationships between indie developers, Zoe Quinn, and people in the gaming press. It was the catalyst for what has set everything else off. You could no more remove Zoe Quinn from corruption in game journalism than you could remove Richard Nixon and Watergate from corruption in politics. It is the focal point, it is the starting point, it is the catalyst. By refusing to address it, you're hand-waving us off.
The mainstream media, such as Kotaku, such as IGN, such as GameSpot, so on and so forth, glazed over the other things that were going on behind the scenes, the possible corruption that was going on behind the scenes, where you have developers fraternizing with journalists, and that could be skewing scores. You have, again, what people do in their bedrooms, I could care less about. But when it affects the industry, and it could affect game scores, and it could affect how credible journalists are. That's what people were concerned about. And what people were angry at, and why people were angry at places like Kotaku, is you guys weren't talking about it. And that's what made people angry too, is like, why are they trying to sweep this under the rug? This whole thing with Zoe Quinn and the Five Guys, and how it could have caused corruption in the industry.
Gamers continued to push the issue, digging through Anita Sarkeesian's past, and they found some damning footage.
I'm going to show you a remix that I just finished this weekend and no one else has seen. It's a soundtrack of one song, except I'm doing video games. So it's not exactly a fandom. I'm not a fan of video games. I actually had to learn a lot about video games in the process of making this. I would love to play video games, but I don't want to go around shooting people and ripping off their heads, and it's just gross.
Anita claimed that she was a longtime gaming enthusiast.
I'm a gamer and I enjoy games. I love games. I'm a fan of games.
It added weight to her critique that gaming was sexist and misogynistic because it was coming from within the community. It was something that was even cited when the gaming industry gave her an award for her activism.
She loves video games.
She's so passionate about them that she feels they're worth fighting for.
Yet 2 years before she started her feminist crusade, she was claiming not to be a fan of video games. They were gross. In the eyes of the Gamergate movement, they weren't being critiqued by a fellow gamer. Anita represented a woke invasion of their community. The radical feminist crusaders were looking like frauds. It was around this time that the mainstream media decided to get in on the game to defend their comrades.
Gamergate started as a hashtag on Twitter, a banner under which people could collectively argue, vent, or attack an idea or an individual. In Gamergate's case, that individual was Zoe Quinn.
The media began crafting the narrative that the women were victims of a misogynistic community. They ran with the most egregious anonymous attacks against Zoe Quinn and Anita Sarkisian, attacks that university school officials didn't deem as credible.
Gamergate, what started as an online backlash against feminist critics of the video game industry, has now turned into threats of a school shooting at a university in Utah. Ugly things are being said on Twitter.
A heated debate in the video game industry has turned ugly and has escalated to include death threats. It's known as Gamergate. And it's gotten so bad that two women have left their homes because of online threats, and another woman, an award-winning games journalist, has said she will never report on the industry again.
The games are fantasy, but the threat of violence, all too real for one woman who dared to say enough. When she spoke out against these representations of women, she received death threats in return.
Gamergate. You might have heard that term. It's the story that has produced threats of mass shootings, forced a woman to move from her home recently after rape threats, and made front page headlines around the country in recent days.
Violent depictions of women being beaten, raped, and run over by cars. It's not the movies, it's video games. And now the women calling for change in this multi-billion dollar virtual industry are facing a very real backlash, including death threats.
What I think's going on is that there's a cultural spasm happening that nobody expected, that accompanies the sort of mainstreaming of video games and the diversification of video games. I think the conventional audience is really shaken up. I think in part because they're sexist, in part because they're used to, you know, being explicitly catered to as a precious special market demographic. And they feel like they might get left behind.
You asked why this is happening. I think the reason is, you know, for 30 years now, video games has really been perceived as a boys' club. You know, you have video games made by men for men. And I think in 2014, where almost half of the video game players are women, I think you're seeing some very insecure guys, like, feeling very threatened by that and, you know, lashing out at us being in their space.
We know you're still getting threats. We're not disclosing your location today for that reason. How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there. I mean, it's been an incredibly long 2 months. Some of the writers who've quit have decided, you know what, this isn't worth it anymore. I can take my skills and go to any other field and not have to deal with this, and I don't blame them.
In one ABC News segment, they showed Anita being escorted to public events by male guards. It was an interesting juxtaposition. The critic of Damsel in Distress games was now the real-life damsel in distress. And she had men protecting her.
For Anita Sarkisian, this is the new normal. Armed escorts at public events.
But just when it looked like the mainstream media's carpet bomb approach could work, a relatively unknown journalist entered the scene. And he'd almost single-handedly get the media rethinking their support for free speech.
Welcome back to Red-Pilled America. So Anita Sarkisian and Zoe Quinn went on a media blitz branding themselves as victim of misogynist, even terroristic gamers, instead of investigating the relevant issues the Gamergate movement was raising about corruption in gaming journalism. The mainstream media instead amplified the radical feminist message. But just when it looked like the carpet bomb approach could work, a relatively unknown journalist entered the scene. His name was Milo Yiannopoulos, a British writer who'd been making a name for himself across the pond by taking counterintuitive positions on controversial issues.
Is it right that same-sex unions should be allowed to share the same honorable estate as Charles and Diana, Fred and Rosemary West, and the 55 hours an addled Britney Spears spent with some guy? With me to discuss it are Milo Yiannopoulos, writer for the Catholic Herald, who is Catholic and gay, and Boy George, a musician and singer, who is also, I was surprised to learn, gay. Thank you both for coming.
Thank you.
Milo, you're gay, but you don't think there should be gay marriage. What's your problem with it?
Well, I think that the question, what we're talking about at the moment, is whether we should legalise gay marriage. And the issue is what we're talking about. We're talking about civil marriage, not religious marriage. So the question we're asking is, does this provide any rights or benefits to gay people that they wouldn't have otherwise had? The answer is no. Because this isn't about equality. If it were a question of equality, then I would be all for it. But it's not really about equality. It's about redefining an institution that is the cohesive glue of society in a way that may yield consequences we have no clue about now.
Milo had been critical of gamers in the past, but now saw something remarkable occurring in Gamergate. Gamers were fighting back against the feminists, and they were winning. They'd forced gaming outlets to change their journalistic policies, effectively admitting there was a potential for corruption in the system. This was something you rarely saw in modern culture. Andrew Breitbart took on the entire legacy media and forced the resignation of a sitting congressman using Twitter. Now Milo saw the same thing happening with Gamergate. Shortly after the Gamergate hashtag began trending on Twitter, Milo started covering the story for Breitbart News. The headline of his opening article read, "Feminist Bullies Tearing the Video Game Industry Apart." He chronicled the whole affair, then closed his article stating, quote, "Those of us with some critical distance from the chaos can only sit back and marvel at how wide-ranging and fundamental the damage to the indie games industry has been these last 2 weeks." He continued stating, quote, "There are now two bitterly opposed factions in the industry, journalists and activists who care more about gender politics than the video games they are supposed to be reporting on, and gamers, mocked, derided, and bullied. But unbowed, video gamers and video game culture will never be the same again," end quote. At the time, he was provocative, but he had a rather reserved, proper British approach. However, that was all about to change. Milo was in the process of entering the fight with the gamers with his novel flair to communicating, and when he did, free speech as we know it would go through a monumental shift.
Coming up on Red Pilled America...
Feminist bullies, and do I think that's a fair representation? Yes, I do.
Gamers do not hate women.
And isn't it hilarious that it kind of spawned out of a dispute about video games?
Gamergate won, and it has ignited so many fires in so many places with so many unexpected consequences.
We need people to actually enforce their own terms of service and shut down bad actors.
I think that the online social media sites really need to step up and change the way that their systems operate.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by me, Adriana Cortez, and Patrick Carelci for Informed Ventures. Thanks for listening.